The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Champions League semi-finals drama. Barcelona hit road in bus like Cliff Richard in summer holiday and look almost as unlikely to score. After their San Siro defeat, we ask, are the champs heading for the exit? And what's the story with Balotelli in his dressing room bust up with his own teammates? There's Sid on the line from Spain, Raphael Honigstein from Munich on Bayern's clash with Lyon, in which Robin starred but then got coach sick, and Ribéry's tackle got him into trouble, not for the first time. Meantime, back in England, it's shaping up to be a blistering round of games in the Premier League. We preview the action, hear your posts, and do much, much more besides in Football Weekly. Together now, extra. On board Football Weekly Extra today, we have Owen Gibson, who's just taking a swig of ill-timed water. Oh, Owen, fine. Hello.
Morning.
Good morning to you. Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
Aha. And Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Let's start with Inter Barcelona, the big footballing story of the week, perhaps the season. Barcelona taken down a peg or several by Jose Mourinho's Inter with a magnificent performance. Albeit one aided by the winds of fortune, Paolo Bandini.
Yeah, I mean, you could stack up the things that went in their favour. Obviously, the referee made a few decisions. Certainly, an offside decision on there should have been an offside decision on Milito's goal for the third. Barcelona certainly should have had at least one penalty, and they would say more than one. And also, Barcelona, you know, were as other teams travelling in Europe affected potentially by having to travel so far this week. But you know, you can put all that on one side and still say that Inter played in a way that no one has played against Barcelona this season. And, you know, I'm sure Sid will have more of a view on this later, but, you know, possibly no one's played against Barcelona in some time. You know, they really, yes, they conceded the goal first, but once they sort of got into their stride, they really handled the game, basically.
Well, I thought it was pretty much how Mourinho played at Chelsea and how Hiddink dealt with Barcelona last year. There were two defensive midfielders suffocating the space for Xavi and Messi to operate. He had Eto'o and Pandev, they trapped back on the wing, so that stopped Alves and Abidal coming forward. But basically the idea was to keep as a tight back eight or nine squeezed together on the edge of the area and made it very hard for Barcelona to play through them. I think Ibrahimovic, which Sid has often talked about being the game breaker, the person that can change things, clearly didn't. He had another absolute shocker.
Mm. Got one out of ten in one of the Spanish papers.
Yeah. I think what Sean says about the structural rigidity of Mourinho's formation is interesting. I think what's also true is that he said last season, I think we raised this in the pod last season, he said at the beginning, to win in Europe, you need to play 4-3-3. And you could call this a 4-5-1, you could call it a 4-2-3-1, as I think what they call it in Gazette. But essentially, this is the same formation, as you say, that you played at Chelsea, which is two wide attackers, one central attacker, and then a midfield, which is composed of two very defensive sitting players and one who's got a little bit more of a freer role.
But if it ain't broke, you know, it works.
No,
it works.
I just think it's interesting that, you know, last season at Inter, he said he needed to do this and he couldn't do it and he didn't get out of the first knockout round. This season, he's done it and, you know, here he is.
Right. It's the new players, isn't it? You
know? Well, it wasn't just, indeed, players. It wasn't just kind of the Mourinho tactical noose. It was also fantastic performances from Zanetti, for example, who completely overshadowed his Argentine compatriot, Messi, for me. Is Stultus posting in saying, Maicon, who, to be fair, hasn't had, in all respects, the best of seasons, but has chipped him some brilliant goals of late. And he says, Dani Alves better practice his cheerleading ability in preparation for the World Cup, because obviously those two rivals for the right-back slot for Brazil. Coltrane 27 and Lee Marvin is my hero, joining in the praise for Javier Zanetti. Says Lee Marvin is my hero. He must be easily 108 years old, but he dispossessed Messi about 40 times and had an all-round belter of a game. Special mention for Samuel too, another Argentine, who's really benefited from playing beside Lucio.
I was just going to say, it's incredible though as well how Mourinho does seem to raise his teams for these big games. You know, obviously they've been slightly indifferent in some of their league form of late, haven't they? But you know, it's just for these massive games, he does seem able to rouse them.
Yeah, not to Balotelli though, not Mario Balotelli, who he brought on with about 15 minutes to go. Mm-hmm. The crowd was so unimpressed with Balotelli's performance that they took to booing and jeering him. And he responded by telling them all to go and get stuffed, only in slightly stronger terms. And then continuing to imprecate. Is that a word in English? No. Generally F and blind everybody and all and sundry as he walked off the field, taking off his shirt and throwing it to the ground in disgust. Mm. After which, He was then set upon, apparently, in the tunnel by Marco Materazzi. And today's reports are that even in the dressing room, there was violent altercation with Lucio. Who were the other players? Milito, apparently, was furious. The charge basically being that Balotelli, who had thought during the week that he was going to be a starter, there was a lot of talk in the Gazetta that he was going to be in the starting lineup, was so offended at not being in the first 11 that he basically just strolled around in his 15 minutes. And, you know, this was very much what Mourinho was alluding to when he said, you know, other players gave the rule, came off the pitch virtually dead, and this bloke could have done a lot more.
When you said set upon,
apparently it turned physical.
I mean, with Materazzi involved, was there any Matrix style moves?
Yeah, no, apparently there were some kicks and stuff, although
shoes were thrown.
Shoes, yes.
Yeah, boots, I would imagine.
And there was also those bizarre scenes in the car park underneath afterwards, when Balotelli basically had to be escorted by Massimo Moratti, the Inter owner, to his car to prevent things getting ugly down there as well.
Yeah, I mean, his agent, Mino Raiola, has come up today and said, he's handing a transfer request for the end of the season, but he's also said that he expects the club to put serious attention into providing security for Balotelli for the rest of the season, because they think he needs to be protected now, and effectively protected from his own teammates seems to be the implication.
He's also threatening to take Inter to court if they don't release him.
Yeah, basically they're suggesting that if Inter refuse the transfer request, they're going to take them to court and accuse them of bullying, effectively. They're going to point to Mourinho's handling of him earlier in the season and now his teammates handling of him.
Doug the Head and Alex Mellows posting and are tweeting in to ask where we think Balotelli will be playing his football next year.
Well, obviously the team who are being linked with it, pretty much everyone who comes available in Italy at all in the last few months, is Man City, both for the money and the fact that Roberto Mancini is there. Some people would also say that, Mancini handled Balotelli so much better in his first season. I'm not really sure that's true. I don't think there was any... I'd be surprised if Balotelli would wax lyrical about Mancini. But that's the obvious destination, because while there are other teams in Italy might be interested, obviously he said before he's a Milan fan, I just don't see them raising the money. And
it's just what they needed there, isn't it? Another divisive dressing room character.
If it's going to be anywhere at the moment, I can only see it being an English club, because I don't think he's got enough stature for Real Madrid, and I don't see who else is going to pay the fee.
All right then. Let's hear from Sid Lowe in Spain on the Spanish view of Tuesday's game. Is he there?
Hello.
Yeah, he is. Sid. Well, first up then, what are the papers making? What did they say post-Tuesday?
Well, it depends which side of the divide you're looking at. Again, we've had this situation in the Madrid press, or at least in the Madrid sporting press, that the Champions League semi-final is really just an audition for the Santiago Bernabeu, and it's an audition for who's going to be the next coach of Real Madrid. So in the quarterfinals, they were talking about the Bayern Munich-Manchester United game as being all about whether or not Ribéry could prove that he was good enough for Real Madrid, and the one player that proved that he was Iron Robin. This time round, it's about whether Mourinho can prove he's good enough for Real Madrid. So the headline on Marca the day after the game was Mourinho a step closer to the Bernabeu, which of course, strictly speaking, he is, because that's where the final is, but I think they were talking about a little bit more than just the final. And AS as well was talking about it being round one for Mourinho, and he's delivered the first blow, maybe not the knockout blow, but the first blow in this tie. And then the other argument, obviously on the other side of the Spanish footballing media divide, is in Catalonia, where, and I'm sure Chelsea fans will feel desperately sorry for them, they're complaining about the referee.
I was just going to say, it's interesting on that point, just because there was a confrontation between Mourinho and Xavi in the tunnel after the game. And Xavi is supposed to have said something about, what about that referee? And Mourinho goes, oh, you must be referring to Evrebo.
Mourinho quite brilliantly handled Xavi. And actually, Xavi's done this twice now in 4 days, because he complained very, very bitterly about the referee in the Espanyol game, the Barcelona derby at the weekend. Then they travelled to Milan and complained again. And yeah, as you say, in the tunnel, he said to Mourinho, oh, I'm sure you're happy with your Portuguese mate, the referee. And Mourinho said, and were you happy with that Norwegian last year?
Yeah. Mourinho then was very magnanimous in the press conference afterwards. He said, it's hard when you're like me or Xavi and you win a lot to accept defeat.
Magnanimous is not the word the Spanish press is using for what Mourinho was like in the press conference, by the way. They're saying that Mourinho was deliberately winding up, that he's provoking them, and here we go again, another round in this long run of Barcelona against Mourinho clashes. Remember, Mourinho was talking about Barcelona being the home of theatre a few years ago, and so on and so forth, and this is really being built up now for a pretty tasty atmosphere on Wednesday.
From Real Madrid's point of view, meanwhile, the only way of redeeming, if you like, the Champions League final at the Bernabeu this year will be if it is Mourinho there and he's got a Real deal and he wins it. So there you have the next Real manager winning the Champions League.
And that would fit their policy perfectly. And I know this sounds a little bit harsh, but I think it's true. It would be classic Real Madrid, that, wouldn't it? Someone else has won something, let's buy him. There's no model, there's no idea, there's no ideology behind what Real Madrid do. It's let's buy the person who wins. And one of the best ways of buying that is look at the players who Real Madrid have had who've won the Ballon d'Or in recent years. Kaká, Cristiano Ronaldo, Luis Figo, Ronaldo, Zidane. Not one of them, and Michael Owen, in fact, not one of them won the Ballon d'Or while a Real Madrid player. They were bought because of the Ballon d'Or. It's as if it was France football doing the scouting for them.
Sid, listen, of course, Inter are still a long way, 90 very, very longo minutos from the Bernabeu. You know, the famous stat, last time Barcelona lost 3-1 in the first leg of a Champions League knockout match, they went on to beat Chelsea 5-1 in the return back in the year 2000. What's the mood, say, in the Catalan press? Are they optimistic about their chances of turning this one around?
I think they're pessimistic, but on the face of it, the message is a very optimistic one in that what they're talking about campaigns, they're talking about fight backs, they're bringing up, as you can imagine, all the examples of times like the Chelsea one when Barcelona have done this before. They're showing how often Barcelona have scored goals, but I do think they're concerned about it. There's been a lot of talk of, obviously, Barcelona went to Milan by bus, but there's been a lot of talk of Mourinho turning up by bus as well and parking the goal line and making it impossible for them to find a way through. I think I personally think they're all missing a point here. I don't think the point is can Barcelona win 2-0. I think Inter will score. And I think that's the thing that perhaps has been overlooked. There's an assumption that Inter will make it difficult, which I'm sure they will. But I just don't see them not scoring on the break against Barcelona. And then there's another thing as well. Shouldn't UEFA, in the interest of fairness, shouldn't they force Milan to come by coach?
Sid, you've often talked about Ibrahimovic being bought for such circumstances like this, where teams park the bus. Your man let you down again, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, absolutely. And Barcelona... you're right, and we've talked about this a lot. This is exactly what Barcelona wanted Ibrahimovic for. There's a question mark, I suppose. Was he fully fit? Because, of course, bear in mind that he'd only played 7 minutes, I think it was, against Espanyol the weekend before. He'd come back from an injury. But he just looks so lethargic and looks so lazy. And here's a stat for you. Ibrahimovic ran less than Victor Valdes, the Barcelona goalkeeper. And I think that is, it's just a stunning stat that really does leave him, I think, very much in the eye of the storm now. A lot of people are pointing the finger at him and saying, well, hang on, this is exactly what we wanted this guy for, and he just didn't do it. The fact that that very early chance, rather than putting his head on it, he kind of waved his heel at it in a kind of slightly effect kind of way, and he just didn't do it for Barcelona.
Interesting, Sid. Well, we'll talk more about what awaits at the Camp Nou, perhaps, in Monday's Football Weekly. In the meantime, thank you very much for that brilliant summary of the post-game reaction, etc., in Spain, Catalonia, and have a lovely weekend.
I shall try. Speak to you on Monday.
Thanks, Sid. Well, of course, there was another semi-final this week. Bayern Munich taking on Olympique Lyonnais. We're hearing a little bit more about that from our man Raphael Honigstein, who was there in the Allianz Arena, right after this.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
Now, joining us on the line from Munich Airport, Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Hello, Raphael. How's it going?
Hi. It's going very well, thank you.
That's great. You have a spring in your step, no doubt, and a certain bounce in your voice as well after your night at the Allianz Arena. Did you enjoy it?
Enjoyed it very much. It was a tremendous atmosphere, which is not something you can say for Bayern games regularly. Usually the crowd is very passive, but they were really up for it. And the fact that Ribéry was sent off and there was a sense of injustice, a wrong sense of injustice, because nobody had really seen in the stadium what had happened, it really got the crowd behind them, and I think it was part of the reason why Bayern came back very strongly.
So in a way, ironically enough, it almost helped Bayern, do you think?
I think it helped them a little bit. I think it also helped them in terms of confidence when they saw that Lyon, despite being a man up, still didn't really do anything. Whether that was by design or by default, I really don't know. But they contained them really well. And then, of course, once it was even again, then they started dominating again the home side. So I think they just got a lot of confidence from that game in the way that they really played against a difficult side to break down. They looked very comfortable in the end.
There was a lot of talk about the number of missed chances that Bayern had, and maybe they could come to regret them. But how do you think they'll be feeling about this 1-0 win?
Well, they're a little bit in two minds about this. On one hand, I think they prefer 1-0 to 2-1 for obvious reasons. So they're quite happy with that result. And also the fact that Ribery was sent off and it looked as if they had to play for 0-0 at least for 20 minutes, then made the 1-0 look even better in retrospect. Then you're right. I mean, they did create a few chances. None of them really that clear-cut, though. So I think it's sort of the right result for the right performance in a way, and they're quite happy.
All right. So Ribery's going to be missing in the second leg, and of course that's just one of the many problems afflicting him at the moment. What's the feeling about that?
Well, I think the fallout is going to start today, the recriminations. Yesterday the players came out and said, yeah, well, we're all behind him. But it sort of fits in with the couple of weeks he's had on and off the pitch. On the pitch, he looks a little bit forlorn. When Bayern beat Hannover 7-0 and Robin scored a hat-trick, Ribery looked a little bit jealous, looked a little bit as if he turned up to his own party only to see somebody else sort of go home with the prettiest girl. So I don't know if that's a good metaphor in the right circumstances right now, but it was a bit like that. It did seem a bit annoyed at Robin's success. And of course, now he put Bayern into a lot of trouble. I suspect him to miss the final as well if Bayern were to reach it, because I can't see UEFA him not benning him for at least two games. And in a funny little way, I think it might increase his chances to stay, because I think the possible suitors, possible clubs to buy him, are getting a bit cold feet maybe.
Mm. Meanwhile, lovely scrap, lovely bit of Dutch camaraderie there as Robin was called off shortly before the end of the game.
Yeah, it was great. It's just Van Gaal, typical Van Gaal, wasn't it? To show that even the best man is not untouchable. A, he needs to come off, and B, he needs to be making a nice face. And afterwards, Robin was kind of, well, very relaxed about this. He said, you know, obviously I'm wanted to stay on. I felt very good, but the coach was right to take me off. So not really a scrap as such, but I think it showed you just how confident Van Gaal is and just how in the space of 4 months, he's turned it around from somebody who was about to get fired to somebody who's now untouchable and maybe on the verge of a triple. So it's been a remarkable turnaround for him.
Nice one, Raphael. Listen, one last question. Fulham's 27-hour cross-continental bus trip concludes with the match against Hamburg this evening. Hamburg, who are, as you've mentioned on many occasions, in the midst of a bit of upheaval regarding their own manager. What are the prospects for the Cottagers in that game?
I think the prospects are pretty good. Hamburg are missing a few people. They've had lots of injuries. They've had a very divided dressing room. Different factions not getting on with each other. Different factions not getting on with the manager, who will be fired at the end of the season, come what may. I think that is certainly what the people in Hamburg are thinking. And I think it's a good time to play them. At the same time, Hamburg's few and far between good performances have all come in the Europa League this season, where the players seem to be motivated and up for it. And of course, they've got that big goal to play the final at their home ground on May 12th. So I think it's you'd make Hamburg still favourites, small favourites, but Fulham showed that they've got a fantastic game plan against Wolfsburg, and I think they can again frustrate another Northern German team tonight.
Brilliant. Raphael, listen, have a super safe journey back home, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, James.
Thanks, Raphael. Raphael Honigstein there on his way back from Munich. A gorgeous stadium, shining like a big orange lozenge, I thought, there on Wednesday night, Sean.
It's a great stadium. I've had the pleasure to report that I did the Brazil v Australia game in the 2006 World Cup, and you can see the stadium. It's quite a long walk from the U-Bahn, and you can see it glowing different colours. And when you're there, well, certainly in the press box anyway, there are huge seats. It's like being in one of those new multiplex cinemas, and you've got your little TV and there's drinks on hand. It's great.
Like being at home in many ways.
Possibly. It certainly beats sort of, you know, I don't know, some of the stadiums I've reported from.
Right. It served as some of the inspiration for the Soccer City Stadium in Johannesburg as well, which kind of has also got these sort of lights shining out from what's supposed to resemble an African cooking pot, I believe.
Oh, well, nice. I'll be there for the World Cup, so we'll be able to tell you more about it come June.
Now, that's so very true. You had some World Cup related news I thought you wanted to...
Yeah, basically we've relaunched the Guardian's Fans Network on the site, and basically what we're hoping to do is to find well-informed football fans to add depth and insight to our coverage.
Right.
So if anyone's interested, they can go to... They'll find the link on guardian.co.uk/football.
Mm-hmm.
All they have to do is basically send us a couple of hundred words about the team they support,
right,
a bit of analysis, why they think they should be part of the network. And what we're hoping they'll do is if they're selected, they'll tweet throughout the tournament. They'll send us pictures of how the World Cup's been celebrated in their area. We'll promote their Twitter feed. We'll promote their blog.
Right.
And we'll also give them the opportunity to pitch for paid work for The Guardian and the website.
Crikey. There you go. Exciting news, listeners. In other exciting football news, Portsmouth in badly managed shocker. This is a turn up, the publishing of their accounts. And some extraordinary figures here among the many, many debts. What, 120 million?
122, I think, is where we got up million. To last night, yeah.
All right. Is it still rising or something?
It does. Well, more things seem to be thrown into the pot. I mean, Andrew Andronicki, who's the administrator, seems to add a few million on every time he speaks. But
it's a shocker, though, isn't it?
Obviously, it comes as no surprise to find out that Portsmouth have been badly run and owe a lot of money. But when you see it laid out sort of in black and white like this, it does really throw into sharp relief the football creditors rule, which means that, you know, your Sol Campbells and David James obviously get paid in full, whereas, you know, King Edward VI School and St John's Ambulance will only be getting sort of 20-25p
pucker
in the
pies.
Pound. Poor old pucker pies.
They're owed £40.
I think they'll
King,
be fine.
They're owed over £1,000. The Ministry of Defence, I'm troubled by this one. Why is the Ministry of Defence owed £626.85?
Got no idea. And why was there also a ransom demand for a ransom payment of £308 listed in the Portsmouth income?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about ransom payments. What do they exactly consist of?
We've got no idea. It's completely.
Oh, really? It's just ransom payment. I thought it might be a kind of an accounting term, but
I mean, what kind of prisoner do you have to be to demand a ransom payment of only £308?
Hmm. Well, maybe that's just the last instalment that hasn't been paid.
I reckon you must be so far down the chain. You must be kind of
exactly. If you've only got John Utaka in the cupboard, then yeah.
But he's paid £80,000 a week, Utaka, which is...
The Scouts Association of Guernsey are owed £697.
Mm. Aren't Qatar Airlines owed 20p?
I believe they are, yeah.
Which is, you know, you think you've paid most of the bill for flying, you know, what's an extra...
Yeah, well, there's probably an administration.
I mean, there is a lot of sort of prurient interest in going through these 15 pages, but, you know, kind of when you put it all together, it is just a sort of shocking picture. Mm. And if you put that alongside the Manchester United bond offer from earlier this season, you've kind of got the set text on Premier League.
All right, well, Tommy C352 tweeting in saying, are they the tip of the iceberg for clubs about to go under? Because that's a little bit how we reacted to the news when they first went into administration.
I tend to think of Portsmouth in two ways. I mean, on the one hand, they're the far extreme of the sort of live the dream philosophy that also did for Leeds, and also, you know, it was also sort of troubling the likes of Hull and others in that kind of, you know, in that strata of the Premier League, if you like. But there's also another aspect to this, which is that they were not only shockingly mismanaged, but there's an awful lot of behind the scenes shenanigans that have gone on that we don't know the full extent of yet, and the sort of succession of owners, the sort of offshore accounts, and that's a different element to the one that you've also seen at other clubs. What we can say is that there are serious questions still to be asked about why the club was sold when it was, how much it was sold for, how much money went in, how much money came out. Now it's down to the administrator to investigate all of that. Mm. He said he will investigate it. What the fans are saying is, how can you sell the club before you've investigated all of that? And so there is a disconnect there, I think.
You mentioned Hull earlier. I think they may not be exactly the next Portsmouth, but they could certainly go a similar way. I mean, it's very interesting in his programme notes last night, the Hull chairman, Adam Pearson, talked about the extremely short-sighted decisions made by his predecessor, Paul Duffin. You know, he says he had no understanding of football. If we were paying, you know, 40 million in wage bill when the club turnover is 50 million, you know, these figures clearly show the maths don't add up. Mm. And he says the future is very tricky. The club desperately needs to stay in this league.
I mean, they've all massively, obviously, overpaid for players and
pucker pies as well.
But they've had no control over wages. They've all kind of gambled on, oh, we need the one extra signing that will keep us up. But on top of that, often the money that fans thought was going in, you know, every set of fans has thought they've got an Abramovich on their hands. When actually, when we see the accounts, it often transpires that no money's gone in at all. It's gone in as loans, or it's been shuffled through, you know, various Byzantine accounting structures, and that no actual cash has gone in.
So often the money's actually gone out.
Indeed.
Yeah. In other news, Edrin Mutu got a 9-month ban for his double positive for sibutramina. It's a dieting drug, is that right?
I believe it's a hunger, an appetite suppressant.
Oh, nice one. And they were asking for 12 months. He got 9. What's this mean? Is he...
he means he's not playing again for another 9 months, okay. Which is, you know, obviously disappointing because he was playing well against Fiorentina before all this. So,
all very unfortunate. And of course, no, he hasn't got any further with getting rid of that massive sum that he's meant to be paying Chelsea.
No, I've heard no more on that. I mean, I think the court case is all still, you know, the legal proceedings of that are yet to kick off properly. So.
Right. Yeah, okay.
He'll have time on his hands to prepare, I guess.
He certainly will. Also in Italy, Roma this week qualified for the Coppa Italia final on the 5th of May. And I mention this because it means they'll be taking on Inter in the final for the fifth time in 6 seasons.
Yep.
Fresh and lively. Nice one. Now, a couple of posts here. Patrick Rennie asking about the business of wearing the colours of Newton Heath. Whatever happened to Newton Heath? Asked Patrick Rennie. Some unconfirmed sources, he says, suggest that after racking up enormous debts, they declared themselves bankrupt and were eventually bailed out by wealthy businessmen, thus becoming Manchester United. Is this true? If so, what delicious irony. We don't know if that's true, but it certainly would be an irony. Oh, interesting latest move, this, from the anti-Glazer Brigade, who are suggesting now they're going to push the boundaries of legality in their attempts to dissuade corporate clients.
Well,
from,
the anti-Glazer Brigade, or MUST, they're trying to sort of distance themselves from that really? Today. I mean, basically, it was something that was all over the Manchester United message boards earlier this week. A disgruntled employee has posted what purports to be a list of the executive boxes holders and sort of is asking for boycotts. But what MUST have been trying to do is to frantically downplay any suggestion of sort of violent protest or because it distracts from what the Red Knights are trying to do, which is, well, after all, put together a bid that they hope the Glazers will accept. So they're stuck in a bit of a quandary about how vehement to be with their protests at the moment.
Right, okay. Let's see, what else? John Barnes Jr. Hey, oh, Jimbo, you say you read all of these posts, so I'd like you to give some props to my housemate, Paul Martinovich, who created your campaign petition. This, he's the man who got my hopes up unnecessarily, but many, many thanks to him and everyone who's indeed signed up for that, Sean.
So you're not going to be the next presenter match today, too, then?
Well, not according to Owen Gibson's Digger column, in a major shock. Thomas McCann down in autumn, interesting, tweeting in saying, would Jimbo be willing to have it out on a live national TV debate against Colin Murray and Tim Lovejoy for the MOTD 2 crown? So yes,
I would love to see that. We should invite them into this studio,
right,
onto our turf, with producer Pete in the box.
Well, surely we should have three: one here, one on five with Colin Murray, and then where's Tim Lovejoy these days? In that cookery place and the recipes.
He's
going to
be the new
Blue Peter presenter, isn't he?
Is he?
So you could do that with whoever.
Somebody think of the kids. Anyway, Simon Hattonston. Lots of people posting in this week, including Barry Glendenning. Here we go in Stilton and Kiffin Botcheza. Saying, Simon Hattonston was a breath of fresh air when he was on the pod. It's a shame he's never been back. Although not entirely a surprise, given the reaction that he prompted. Is Simon joining us for the World Cup tour?
I think Simon was absolutely shocked and horrified by the post that he got. And I don't I think we could ask him back, but I've spoken to him since, and I think he would tell me where to go with a big... In a very polite way, but he would tell me where to go.
All right, then. Fish Without a Bike says, I've heard Roberto Mancini has what's been described as a quiet hatred for Fabio Capello. And even Carlo Ancelotti didn't seem too keen on the England coach when you interviewed him for 442, James. Yeah, that's true. He had a bit of a chuckle at Capello, actually. What exactly is Fabio's relationship with Italy and most Italian managers? Why do they seem to dislike him? Well, I would say that I don't think there's a manager who likes Capello.
I'm not sure there are that many players who'd say they like him. I say there's a lot of people who say they respect him, which is a different thing. But yeah, I think he's not cultivated friendships, but he's, you know, not what he set out to do.
No, indeed not. Gunner Who, should we finish off with Gunner Who? A special pun for AC Jimbo. Yesterday, apparently this is a true story, a notoriously violent Melbourne gangler boss, Carl Williams, was beaten to death in prison with part of an exercise bike. The headline in the Australian newspaper, Vicious Cycle Catches Up with Williams. Oh dear. Right. Good. Many thanks for your posts. Stilton, your alien first 11. Fantastic stuff there. We'll be looking at more of those on Monday, of course. But in the meantime, we're going to race on towards part 3, and I'll look forward to the weekend. Yes, the weekend, and it is a big weekend. Chelsea, of course, 1 point clear at the top of the table, hosting Stoke at Stamford Bridge, while Man United take on team of the moment, Tottenham Hotspur. Post-Arsenal, post-Chelsea, Can Spurs do it again?
I think it's very unlikely they'll win Old Trafford. You just look at their record against the big four away. They've won none of the last 66 Premier League games. Away against the big four. In total, they've played 71 matches in the Premier League. They've won 2, drawn 21, lost 48. They've never beaten Manchester United, Old Trafford in the Premier League.
But, history be damned and all that, because but I think they showed against Arsenal that the record books don't count for anything. Looking at this team, do you not see a spirit there that they could go to a weakened United side? And
But people said much the same thing before they travelled to a weakened Liverpool side earlier this year. And Spurs went back to their slightly pathetic, slightly timid way of playing and got well beaten. I'd love to see Spurs show the same imagination and gumption and flair they've shown in the last couple of games at home, but away against the big four they have I think there's some mental problem there.
There's talk once again that Aaron Lennon might be on the bench at least for that game. I've certainly seen reports to that effect Thursday morning. Azu Bamboo says, just wondering what the pod thinks about the news that Fergie's told the board that he's going to leave in the summer of 2011. Should we take it seriously? After all, he has a history of retracting dates. And who will replace him, etc., etc., etc.?
I think, in a word, no, we shouldn't take it seriously, because, I mean, he's made it very clear that he's not going to pre-announce his departure in the same way as he did last time round, which caused all the instability. And there's so much flux anyway with the Glazers and with the Red Knights and so on, that I think it would be, it's an easy thing to write that, yes, he'll definitely go at the end of next season.
So he didn't announce it himself? I hadn't seen that.
No, there's been reports this week as there's been reports at various points over the last 5 or 6 years, that he will, at the end of next season, will be the time at which he stands down. And then everyone started speculating about Mourinho and Moyes and who might replace him. But, I think, obviously, at some point, he will go. It'll be a major problem for Manchester United, and that'll be a major point of transition. But that also plays quite interestingly into the takeover talk and what that means about when the Glazers might just sell up,
Well, a huge game anyway against Spurs. Spurs obviously looking to maintain their hold on fourth place, while United chasing Chelsea at the top of the table. Man City, who are just behind Spurs in the race for fourth, are at Arsenal, who are out of the title race now. But all sorts of interesting elements to this game, not least the return of Adebayor to the Emirates after all those unseemly scenes at Eastlands in the first clash between them.
And Patrick Vieira too, although I doubt he'll start.
And Colo Touré.
City's record at the Emirates or Highbury is terrible. They've lost 10 and drawn 2 in the Premier League. I think it's very interesting because we don't know what sort of side Arsenal will play. City, I think there's clearly some fractious behaviour there behind the scenes. It could be anything. As a betting proposition, I'd stay well away from it. But I think it'll be an interesting game to watch.
What fractious behaviour behind the scenes is this?
Well, just with kind of what Bellamy's been saying. Clearly, the club's owners aren't particularly happy with Mancini. It doesn't seem to me, from a distance and speaking to a couple of people in Manchester, that it's a particularly happy camp at the moment.
But I just think when you've got that cocktail of money and ego in the dressing room they've got, that's always going to bubble up after a defeat in a way, isn't it? I mean, it's only 2 weeks ago we were saying what a fantastic run they're on and how they can't stop scoring.
Paolo, Arsenal meantime, as the fourth Gibb was tweeting, Arsenal have gone from potential league winners to potentially losing third place, which perhaps a slight exaggeration.
It's not likely, and I think the odds are still well out on it. But it's not inconceivable that, put it this way, it's not inconceivable that Arsenal drop points against City this weekend. Sean's made a pretty convincing case for why it's unlikely that Tottenham win. But if Tottenham did, and they are in very good form, there's not so many points in it all of a sudden. And if, Arsenal...
7 points, I think, at the moment.
There you go, 7 points. They'll be down to, theoretically, if City were to win and Tottenham to win, they'll be down to 4 points. And Arsenal have got an away game against Blackburn, who have already, drawn with Chelsea and United recently. And they've got... The last game is Fulham at home. Fulham, you would have thought by then, have been pretty content they haven't been playing their best stuff in the league for a while now. They've been playing their best stuff in Europe. But, they're not games that you necessarily say are going to be games that Arsenal can stroll through. And the way Arsenal have played recently and, the way they collapsed against Wigan at the moment, I don't think it's a major fear, but I think that there's, I think you'd find several Arsenal fans who are at least a little bit concerned.
Robin van Persie, who looked good when he returned briefly against Tottenham, but barely featured against Wigan, is he expected to play a bigger role in this game against Manchester?
I'd imagine he'd play more than he did against Wigan. Yeah, I don't know if he's ready to start yet.
All right.
I think the one that the one whose role could end up being more defining is Fabianski, because it looks like Wenger's going to stick by him. And at the moment, it just doesn't seem like he can put a foot right, but perhaps two hands right is what he's doing wrong.
Flappy Hansky, as many national tabloids dubbed him. Well, talking about Man City and Spurs for fourth, but hey, what if Aston Villa would have snuck in there? They had that 2-0 win over Hull midweek. They're now, looks at notes, 3 points, they have played next game, just 3 points behind Spurs. So were Spurs and Man City to come and stuck in their fixtures this week, O'Neill could be back on for a Champions League place, and pundits the length of the land would be monging their words.
They would be indeed, and obviously a bit different complexion on his deliberations over the summer as well about whether he's going to stay or go. But I mean, I can't see it myself. I mean, I think it's still Spurs or Man City.
Well, they've got a huge game themselves, Aston Villa, against Birmingham. That's on Sunday at home to Birmingham, a very keenly felt derby, of course, as so many posters rushed to point out last time. I may have intimated that it wasn't, but yeah.
And also they play Man City in the running as well, so they have a chance. I think O'Neill's recent eruption, well, not that recent, a couple of weeks ago, where he was clearly unhappy. Rumours are that he found out that the club were thinking about selling Milner behind his back to Manchester United, and I think Man City are both interested. And I think he was very unhappy about that.
As Sean said, I think that was what triggered the O'Neill eruption, but not only that, the fact that he. I think he learnt there was very little money to spend on top of that as well. You know, interesting that Milner, did for Keegan at Newcastle, and his been sold behind his back, and then similar history repeating itself here.
Well, interesting. Meanwhile, down at the bottom, Hull, of course, defeated midweek, which puts another nail in their coffin. Perhaps they are at home to Sunderland this week, and morale really low there. They were booed off, were they not, by their own fans in the Villa defeat. They remain 3 points behind West Ham, who are in the last safe position. West Ham will be taking on Wigan. West Ham, they've only had one win in their last nine, so they're hardly a model.
But then Hull have only won twice since Christmas. I mean, God, we keep thinking that sides at the bottom will pull themselves out, but they're just like people wallowing in quicksand. They're just, instead of just getting themselves out, they just let themselves sink. And
The thing with quicksand, though. Yeah. Yeah, no, but, there are no stairs.
But someone's holding my hand. There's right. There are opportunities. I mean,
hands can you see held out towards Hull, then, metaphorically speaking?
Well,
what reasons for optimism or what?
Well, I didn't see the game last night, but I've read the reports, and Hull were apparently appalling.
Really? Because I heard they had plenty of chances, and wasteful finishing was their undoing. Producer Pete saw the game, listeners, and he said they missed a couple of absolute sitters. So there you go. In other relegation news, Burnley will be hosting Liverpool on Sunday. So, well, there you go.
Liverpool are doing that badly yet, are they, James?
And on that bombshell, I think we come to the end of today's Football Weekly Extra. And many thanks then, Sean Ingle, for being with us today. And you, Paolo Mandini.
Cheers.
And you, Owen Gibson.
Thanks.
Producer Pete, many thanks for putting the whole thing together. And listeners, much appreciate your being with us. We will be back on Monday. Make sure you join us then. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.